Well, welcome everybody. Thank you for attending the South Bay's Public Truth. It's wonderful to see a great turnout here tonight. I'd like to introduce the host of tonight's event. Samir Lemon is the Vice President of the Muslim Community Association, the organization which was gracious enough to offer the use of this space for this town hall forum. Samir is also a member of the Interfaith Coalition, and he has a few words of welcome.
Good evening. Can everyone hear okay in the back? Good. Welcome. In our faith, Islam, this means Assalamu Alaikum, and we're glad you're here. My name is Samir Lemon, and on behalf of the Muslim Community Association of the San Francisco Bay Area, we'd like to welcome you here in our home for the public's truth. The Muslim Community Association is proud to co-sponsor the public's truth because it is an opportunity for Santa Clara County's diverse communities to come together to share our stories of how we have all been impacted by post-9/11 policies and practices. Our community, especially in the last 2 years, has known the difficulties of having a place to tell one story in the face of adversity and discrimination. And tonight, we offer our space as a place for the voices of other communities to be heard. We stand united with these communities to speak out against discrimination, against any ethnic group, and to create a new public record that belongs to us all. Our space, the one you're in, serves as a place of worship, learning, and sharing. And tonight, you will be here while some of us will go and practice our prayers. We'll have two of them tonight. One is at 7:10, the other one is at 9 p.m. Tonight here at the Public's Truth, we hope that this space can enable people to come with an open mind and open heart to take in the stories shared by our fellow community members, and for us to bring these stories of courage to our diverse communities when we leave. Thank you, and peace be unto you.
Thank you, Samir. My name is Kenzo Kimura. I am the president of the San Jose Japanese American Citizens League, and our organization is one of the co-sponsors of tonight's event. I'd also like to introduce my co-moderator for the evening. Jennifer Emiko Boyden is a program associate for the Applied Research Center. And I'd also like to introduce Gina Acebo, who is the director of JUMP at the Applied Research Center, who is going to say a few words about the origin of the public's truth.
Good evening. How are you? On behalf of the Applied Research Center and our co-sponsors, I'd like to thank everyone for joining us at the Public's Truth this evening. It has been 2 years since the tragedy of September 11th, but in that time, a barrage of policies, practices, and procedures have been put into place. Measures like the USA Patriot Act, the Student and Exchange Visitor Information System, Operation Tarmac, the Absconder Apprehension Initiative, the Terrorist Information Prevention System, the National Security Entry-Exit Registration System, and Total Information Awareness Initiative. All of these measures have been enacted with minimal public debate or scrutiny, but now serve as a foundation for how the United States defines national security. For the Applied Research Center, our instincts told us that these measures have not only ratcheted up the level of racial intolerance already permeating in our society, but that the results of enforcing these measures come at some level of human cost. The question we were faced with now was, how can we make a case about that? For the last 20 months, we've traveled across the country, speaking with communities and organizations to gain some perspective on how their lives have been altered. Slowly, cautiously, courageously, people shared stories that have painted an appalling, frightening, and maddening picture. For example, in Mississippi, Pakistani jewelry kiosk owners face economic hardship when FBI and INS agents swept through local markets and shut down their businesses, accusing families of running money laundering to support terrorist activity, but without any concrete evidence, except to be held under suspicion because of their country of origin. In Oregon, immigrant Latino workers fell subject to INS organizing sting operations at their work sites. And in rural Kentucky, immigrant workers were subject to early morning home raids, resulting in immediate deportation. In Texas, the federal sweeps post 9/11 had indiscriminately rounded up so many individuals that authorities fashioned giant meat cages as makeshift detention cells for people charged with no specific crimes, but brought in for questioning and detainment because their national origin was of question. In California, community activists working on immigrant rights, workers' rights, and racial justice issues found themselves subject to so-called voluntary interviews with the FBI, which involved interrogation about their political activities, their religious beliefs, and their personal histories. And in Illinois, New York, Texas, Minnesota, and Georgia, family members struggle through the immigration web only to find that their paperwork is backlogged and that there are accusations of fraud, which they are then presented with the sole choice of deportation, thus separating them from loved ones with little recourse or due process. What these stories illustrate is what is terribly wrong and racially discriminatory regarding the host of so-called anti-terrorist policies that are often just anti-immigrant measures in disguise. That's why today, here at the Public's Truth, community members have come forward to share their stories. Their stories are essential in our evaluation of how effective security measures are, but also essential in the establishment of an alternative public record that challenges the recent efforts of Attorney General Ashcroft's tour that has promoted the U.S. Patriot Act, revealing that it is successful. But what these stories reveal tonight is that what is going on with these measures are actually tearing families apart, creating and contributing to a climate of fear, and wreaking havoc and hatred that's led to job loss, injury, and even the threat of death. For many of our cultures here in this room, sharing our stories plays an integral part in understanding our histories and inspires us to take action. Today, at the Public's Truth, we are here to acknowledge, to witness, that these stories are not isolated events, but are merely a glimpse to what is happening to thousands of people across the country and whose stories still need to be told. I thank our testifiers this evening for their courage to share their stories today. And as witnesses, let us make these stories our public record. And let us acknowledge that their stories are our stories. This is the Public's Truth. Thank you.
Thank you, Gina. I wanted to say a few words about the South Bay's Public's Truth. It truly is an honor to be sponsoring this event in what is one of the most diverse areas in the state as well as in the country. The South Bay's Public's Truth is the third iteration of the Public's Truth after successful events in the East Bay. and also in Los Angeles, and will be followed with planned events, Public Truth events in Chicago, Houston, and Atlanta. So we are proud to be included in the list of areas included for Public Truth. You know, I mentioned the diversity of our county, which is one of our truly greatest strengths. However, after September 11th, 2001, hundreds of people of color, including Sikh Americans, Arab Americans, East Africans, South Asians, and Muslims of all ethnic backgrounds, suffered personal attacks and harassment across the nation. Their attackers lashed out at them because of racism, prejudice, fear, and ignorance. According to the Santa Clara County Network for a Hate-Free Community, the number of hate incidents reported in 2001 was 2,500% higher than it was in 2000. And according to law enforcement officials, the actual rate of hate incidents and hate crimes is generally 8 to 10 times higher than what is actually reported. As of June 2003, 59 reports of hate violence have been recorded in Santa Clara County. These incidents are still occurring. Now, 2 years later, incidents of hate, violence, and racial and religious discrimination continue in our backyards. And tonight, I have no doubt that you will be moved by hearing the stories of our testifiers experiencing the human costs of the quest for homeland security in their lives. A few words about the testifiers or storytellers tonight. Some are coming out in public for the very first time to share their stories. Others have chosen a member of the community to share their stories on their behalf because they are so fearful of coming out on their own and in fear of reprisals. Other stories shared today come from people outside of the South Bay, but these testifiers wanted to come to encourage others in the South Bay to come forward with their stories. While all of these stories are individual in nature, I think we will all agree that the stories are going to draw us together as a community. So let's lend our ears, our support, and admiration to all of our speakers for their stories that they are about to share. A few words about the witnesses before us. We are honored to have elected officials and community leaders with us tonight. Their role this evening will be to listen to the stories, to reflect on the stories, and most importantly, to really see how the stories affect the work that they do and the constituencies, formal or informal, that they represent. Okay. About the music that we heard as you entered the building, we'd like to thank and acknowledge Soyinka Brahim, Bay Area artist, for sharing her craft with us this evening to create a safe haven and listening space and to support our testifiers by building a safe environment. The stories you're about to hear are very moving, and the music provides a brief respite from the emotions that will come forth. A quick announcement, if anyone needs Spanish translation, I apologize, please go to Caesar. Please see Caesar. Caesar, raise your hand, please.
Right here.
Over here, okay. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. I took Spanish, but I don't think you want me to do it. Yeah.
Si necesitan traducción en español, César, ¿puede introducir? ¿Dónde está César? Okay. En la mesa de mi mano derecha hay monitores donde les van a poder prohibir con la tradición.
Okay, I'd like to introduce our first set of testimonies tonight. There are two sets. The first set of testimonies is based on the following theme. Since September 11th, policies and the climate that has helped to create these policies have had a real effect on people's lives. The following testimonies will demonstrate the human costs of these policies and practices. Our first testimony is an anonymous personal account and will be read by Shalana De Silva.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Shalana De Silva, Program Associate for the Applied Research Center. This evening, I will be reading the testimony of a San Jose man who went through the special registration process. I came to this country from Iran in 1977 to get an education. After graduating from university, I attempted to get my visa in order. I ran into several unfortunate snags during that process. The final setback to my application was the consequence of my immigration attorney's mistake. She did not file my application on time. Missing that deadline meant that I was out of status. My family in Iran heard about special registration, and my brother suggested that I appear at the INS to legitimate my application process. I had not heard about special registration living in San Jose, California, but after discussing it with my family, I decided to go. So on December 17th, my sister accompanied me to the San Jose INS office. My identifying information was taken along with my photograph and fingerprints. All of the information was placed into a database. I explained to the INS officer that I was out of status and that I had been going through all possible legal channels to change my status. The INS officer then read me my rights. He explained that because I was here illegally, I must be detained. I was taken into a room full of detainees being questioned, and I was interrogated there for 45 minutes. From there, my story becomes a horrifying sequence of events. I was hijacked from San Jose to the INS facility in San Francisco. After being shackled and handcuffed and left to wait for hours in a cold cement cell, I, along with a group of other detainees, were driven to Oakland Airport. From there, we were flown to Arizona and were driven to the Florence Detention Center. I spent close to 10 hours overnight at the Florence Detention Center before heading finally to Colorado, where we only touched down long enough to pick up more detainees. From there, we flew back to Oakland, and from there to Bakersfield. Finally, we ended up in San Diego. During the entire 13 to 14-hour trip, we were shackled and handcuffed. We were never told where we were going to end up. However, our destination was the Corrections Corporation of America, a private contracted facility in San Diego. Altogether, I was detained there for close to 1 week. I was consistently shackled and handcuffed, treated maliciously, and my basic human and civil rights were transgressed, including those of due process and access to necessities such as food, blankets, and even sleep. Because of the intervention of attorney Banafshe Akhlaqi, I was released on bond and returned to my hometown of San Jose. My court date was set for February 2003, 2 months away. If I had not been released on bond, I would have been detained at CCA for those entire 2 months, rather than the days I did spend there. I am required to special register again on my anniversary date in December of this year, along with all of those who did so in December of 2002. The fear has stayed with me. Being taken away from my family and uprooted from my life without warning or explanation was frightening and surreal. I appreciate my freedom a lot more now, being able to shower when I want or eat when I'm hungry. I especially value the meaningful things in life, like being able to stay in contact with my family or being able to make choices for myself. But I'm always looking over my shoulder, as this process is still unresolved. I feel that the founding morals of this country, democracy, fairness, and tolerance, are being ignored in today's post-9/11 environment. My experience is always in my thoughts, and I am the one who feels terrorized today. Thank you.
Thank you, Shalana. The story that we just heard is representative of the racial profiling and inhumane treatment that the Muslim community has been subjected to since 9/11. Attorney General John Ashcroft ordered over 82,000 immigrants from 25 countries to special registration. Over 1,200 were detained without being charged of any crime, and the exact number of detainees is unknown due to government secrecy. None of the thousands of people detained or questioned in response to September 11th have been convicted on terrorism charges. We're hearing the call to prayer right now, and out of respect for that time, we're going to take this opportunity to have a moment of reflection. Our staff will be passing out note cards and pencils, and what we're asking people to do is to write down the name or names of people who you know that have been harmed or are being harmed right now. This time is for bringing those people into our hearts and minds so that the suffering that they've endured will never be forgotten.
Thank you for showing respect in this place of worship. Our next speaker is Jamal Al-Fakhouri. He's the regional director of the International Rescue Committee and will share with us a personal tale, a personal story about refugee programs.
Good evening. I'd like to thank the organizers of this event for inviting me to speak tonight. My testimony is not on behalf of a personal experience, and it's not on behalf of individuals. It's rather on behalf of a program that saved millions of people's lives since 1975. It started with the resettlement of the Vietnamese refugees fleeing after the fall of Vietnam, whereas people had to escape and flee and were saved by the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program. Before I go into details, just a little bit of background on myself. I was born in Jordan of a Palestinian family. Although I didn't grow up in a refugee camp, but I witnessed the lives of many of my friends throughout college, who grew up in refugee camps. And it's not exactly the best of life. So when I came to the United States and finished my education, I went into this profession trying to make difference and a positive impact on the lives of the most unfortunate people who are called refugees. And refugees, in a nutshell, are those individuals who escape persecution or fear of persecution because of discrimination based on their nationality, religion, political affiliation, or membership in any social groups. Under this definition, about 25 million people worldwide right now are considered refugees and are registered with the United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees. The organization I work for is called the International Rescue Committee. The IRC was started in 1933 to protect people fleeing Nazi Germany and help them reach safety to the United States of America. IRC opened an office in San Jose in 1979, and since that date, we've helped resettle over 25,000 refugees who came to Santa Clara County in hope of a better life, security, stability for them and for their children. Under the definition of refugees and under the mission of IRC, we help people of all backgrounds. Vietnamese, Russians, Iraqis, Iranians, Colombians, Cubans, anybody who is registered as a refugee and meets the definition of the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program. In years prior to September 11th, United States accepted annually anywhere between 70 to 122,000 people to enter the United States as refugees. For example, in 1990, over 122,000 were accepted. In 1995, 85,000 refugees entered the country. And in 2001, 69,000. After September 11, refugees all of a sudden, of all background, became suspect of being tourists themselves. And refugee admission started declining. In the immediate impact of September 11th, all refugee resettlement was halted. And when it was started, refugees now have to go through additional security measures to prove that they are not terrorists. That resulted in a sharp decline. For example, in year 2002, only 27,000 refugees entered the United States. And this year, only 25,000 refugees have made it so far. Some of the examples of the added security measures, although refugees go through a process that takes 12 steps from the day they apply for a refugee status to the day they arrive, refugees have to go through additional security measures and resulted in delays and halting of refugee resettlement. I know a number of families that were expecting their family members to arrive on September 11th and the week during after September 11th of 2001, where in September of 2003, those individuals are still languishing in refugee camps in Africa, 2 years after they had their ticket, their airplane ticket in their hands, waiting to get on an airplane. September 11th came, they've been put on hold. 2 years later, they're still living in refugee camps in Africa where they lack the basic necessities for a secure and a decent life. They're still languishing. We're asking the government to streamline the process, to eliminate those added security measures, the bureaucratic delays, and restore the United States leadership program, leadership role in rescuing people's lives. Thank you very much. I'll conclude by a saying, those who are willing to sacrifice certain freedoms in the sake of safety deserve neither safety nor security. This was said by Benjamin Franklin 2 centuries ago. Thank you.
Thank you, Hamal. Our next testimony is by Jaime Jimmy Escobar. He's going to speak about baggage screening.
Good evening to everybody. I am Jimmy Escobar, a former airport screener at the International Airport of San Jose. On behalf of these former airport screeners, I will just relate to you the sad experience that we incurred on our job that were stolen from us. I came to this beautiful country from the Philippines with my wife Lilia in April 1998. We leave our children behind in search of a better future and eventually bring them here. My first job was a checkpoint screener, and my wife also. I worked hard, and after 2 years, I was recommended to take more responsibilities, this time as CTX operator or baggage screener. The training for this job was rigid and rigorous. I was trained according to FAA regulations. I passed both the written and practical examinations. I was certified by FAA. Then came the 9/11 incident, which targeted the airport screeners. We, the airport screeners, were blamed for this tragedy. U.S. Congress passed the law of federalizing all airport securities, thereby creating the Department of Homeland Security, in which its Transportation Security Administration took over the airport checkpoints throughout the United States. The TAIS requirements were all airport screeners must be U.S. citizens and must pass a given test. Also, U.S. screeners on the job were made to take the test. Majority failed the test because, according to them, the test items or questions did not focus or pertain to the knowledgeability of the job. They were irrelevant and discriminatory. All the immigrant screeners, like me and my wife, were laid off because we were not U.S. citizens. And even the U.S. citizens screeners who failed or did not take the test suffered the same fate. Losing our job has a traumatic effect on many of us. My wife and I were not able to sleep very well for several nights and have been depressed. There were bills to be paid, like car amortization and insurance, house rentals and amortization, life and medical insurances, and many financial obligations to be met. We have not been able to send money anymore to our children. Our petition for our children to come here in America is being jeopardized by losing our job. The sad fact of this almost mass layoff of airport screeners involved not only husband and wife, but four or five members of the family, all working in the airport. One of our co-workers suffered a severe stroke after losing her job. She became disabled and is now confined in a care home. Our life will have a bleak future to come. We have been looking for work, but jobs are scarce. Businesses have closed or transferred to other countries. Unemployment has been at its highest, especially in California. Many of us cast in or our life insurances, lost our homes and cars. This is an injustice for blaming us as airport screeners for the 9/11 tragic incident, where we're doing our job well. The TSA Homeland Security Department and the media should blame instead the intelligence agencies for slipping their job. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Escobar. Out of 28,000 screeners nationwide, 10,000 are thought to be immigrants. Over 1,000 are Filipinos in the Bay Area alone.
Our next testimony comes from the Japanese American community. I am a fourth generation Japanese American. My great grandparents were forced into internment camps. My grandparents as well when they were young. And my mother actually was born in an internment camp. I think growing up, they tried to shield my sister and I from information or news about internment because it was a shameful and humiliating experience. They wanted to protect us from it, and so they didn't tell us about it. However, I think an event like September 11th reminded me And I think a lot of Japanese Americans, that the stories of Japanese internment, Japanese American internment, Japanese Latin American internment really do need to be told, because they're a part of history. And unless we learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it. So our next speaker is Kathy Takeda, who will relate a story about her father and grandfather.
Sorry. These podiums aren't made for the vertically challenged here. Hi, my name is Kathy Takeda, and I am the Vice President of Cultural Affairs for the San Jose chapter of the Japanese American Citizens League, and I'm a Sansei, a third-generation Japanese American. As I listen to tonight's stories, 2 years after 9/11, I feel like my dad's story is important, because it seems that we have not learned from what happened to Japanese American families 60 years ago, and history seems to be repeating itself. All we have to do is replace the current victims' names with my dad, Ed Takeda's name, and the same things are happening that have happened to his family. Tonight, I'm here to share his story. It was February 20th of 1942, the day after President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, forcing all Japanese Americans into internment camps. That evening, Dad was sitting home in El Viso, eating dinner with his family. Dad always said that Grandfather was very strict about dinner protocol, which meant that every family member had to be there no matter what. He was 10 years old at the time. As they sat there eating and talking about their day, someone knocked on the door. My grandmother and grandfather looked up at each other with a puzzled look. I wonder, who can that be? Dad said he remembered Grandpa getting up to answer the door, and the next thing, two FBI men burst into the house. Dad said it was so crazy. They asked for my grandfather by name and said he had to leave right away with them that night. The FBI rummaged through the house, opening up drawers, closets, everything, digging through all of the family's personal items and taking out kimonos and asking if they were Japanese flags. Dad said he looked over at his mother and she was crying uncontrollably. Dad said that all he kept going through his mind was, what could we have done to deserve this? Suddenly, everyone was saying goodbye to my grandfather. Dad says he remembers sitting in his father's lap for just a moment, and then he was gone. They left so fast that my grandfather didn't even get a chance to grab his glasses, which could help him see. All the family could think of was, what are we going to do now? When they took Grandpa away, the family had no information on why he was taken away, where he was going, for how long, and when he would return. Right afterwards, my dad and his remaining family were forced to pack a few of their belongings and went to Sanger, California, before being interned in Gila River, Arizona. It wasn't until August of 1942, 5 months after my grandfather's disappearance, that he returned to the family at Gila River. Dad says that Grandpa looked different. He was gaunt, withdrawn, and very pale. And it wasn't until many years later that my dad would learn that his father, like thousands of other first-generation Issei men, had been taken without notice from their families. Most families didn't know why their men had suddenly disappeared, where they were taken, or when they would be released. Almost all of them were Japanese community leaders, faith leaders, news writers, teachers, or organizers. At the time of my grandfather's arrest, he was president of the Japanese Association of California and was an active member in the San Jose Buddhist Church. On the night he was taken away, he wound up in the San Jose City Jail. But like many of his peers, he was secretly shipped off to a Department of Justice detention camp, Fort Lincoln, North Dakota. None of the men there were ever charged with any crime. Grandpa never talked about his time there, but we knew what he had experienced must have been so deep that he buried it deep inside himself in order to carry on with daily life. Then, on September 2001, all of these memories were dredged up again when Dad and I were sitting down watching television And over and over and over again, announcers kept saying, "It's another Pearl Harbor." That really got to Dad. "Here we go again," he said. And I said, "What are you talking about? What do you mean it's happening all over again?" And he said, "You weren't there. You do not know what it's like." Then he started rattling off a list of things that would eventually happen to those in other communities. First, people will be arrested. Then they'll be hauled off to jail. And if they don't watch out, they will end up in camps too. It's so wrong. Since that time, I have found it so eerie that he knew exactly what would be happening now, because it happened to his family and to so many others in the Japanese American community. We cannot let another community go through what we have gone through. It must never happen again. Thank you.
I mentioned a little bit earlier how honored we are to have such key witnesses join us this evening, and at this point we'd like to have them reflect on some of the stories that they've heard thus far. Our first witness we'd like to hear from is Ms. Mary Mabin, who serves as the district director for U.S. Congressman Representative Mike Honda.
Thank you, and it's certainly moving to hear these stories this evening. I'm sure all of you know that the congressman was interned as a very, very young child. So to hear these stories tonight certainly would bring back the memories for him. Congressman Honda votes his values. He certainly voted against the Patriot Act 1. He's prepared to vote against Patriot Act 2. He voted against the war. And he would be appalled at the treatment of immigrants, residents, and citizens as we hear these stories tonight.
Thank you, Ms. Mabin. Next, I'd like to introduce Supervisor Pete McHugh, who serves District 3 in the County Board of Supervisors. Pete was another one instrumental in helping pass a resolution for noncompliance of the U.S. Patriot Act and helped us push it through the Board of Supervisors. So welcome, Pete McHugh.
Thank you, Kenzo. As witnesses, we were asked to listen and to reflect, and I will share my reflections, and they are basically a feeling of anger and shame. I think that the quote that was offered to us by Jamal summed it up. We as a country are in danger of losing what makes us special. It is essential that we stand up for one another, that we respect one another. That means there's an individual obligation for everyone. That means if you are harassed, discriminated against, threatened. It is up to you to stand up and bring that attention to the attention of the authorities, whether that be the local police department, the sheriff, or the district attorney. And while they have all told us that they will do all that they can to prevent such crimes, if you are uncomfortable, then please contact our Hate Free Network or go to the supervisors, and we will see that your complaint is treated. What we have to do, and this forum is a wonderful example, is to speak up, because the greatest danger is to suffer in silence, and then we will have what happened to our Japanese-American citizens. So it's up to us to stand up and make sure that this government doesn't become what it seems to be heading towards. We're in danger of losing a dream. Thank you.
Thank you, Supervisor McHugh and Ms. Maben, for sharing your perspectives. As of last night, three states and 173 cities, towns, and counties have passed resolutions to protect and uphold civil liberties. In fact, the city of San Jose just passed its noncompliance with the Patriot Act resolution just a few days ago.
Our second set of personal testimonies tonight is going to speak about some different issues, equally compelling. Racial profiling, hate, and intolerance permeates all institutions and is especially virulent in an environment fueled by hatred and ignorance. The next testimonies that you hear tell us that none of us is safe, whether it's in our schools, our neighborhoods, in our jobs, and even with our own religions, when racism and discrimination go unchecked. I'd like to introduce Kavneet Singh Alag, Western Regional Director of SMART, the Sikh Media Watch and Resource Task Force.
Thank you. Unfortunately, I'm here today because I actually had a young brother of mine who was a Sikh gentleman on the University of California, Berkeley campus that was attacked during spring break of this year. Let me say that once again, UC Berkeley. So when we have jokes and we talk about conservative versus liberal and educated places, we wouldn't think that UC Berkeley would be a place where we would see hate crimes. I know myself, I was on campus and still at Cal after the attacks of 9/11, and I thought, I'm pretty safe here. This is Berkeley, right? Everybody knows what's going on and knows better than for hate crimes. Sadly, I was mistaken. What I would like to do, at least for now, is to try to share some sentiment and emotion of what the Sikh community really is feeling post 9/11. As I stated before, a young Sikh was attacked on the campus by what appears to maybe be a transient, but they're not sure, who had some sort of shank in his hand and swung at his neck. And from his accounts, which was very heartfelt and we heard a couple weeks ago at a 9/11 event at Berkeley, came within inches of his own throat. A few months after that, another Sikh brother of mine was attacked by three men headed to the gym at the University of Berkeley campus. For the Sikh people as a whole, I think especially in the Bay Area, this is a very disturbing and frightful time. We can see in the last 11 weeks, three Sikh cab drivers have been shot. So this isn't just specifically three shooting crimes, but three shots have been fired at Sikh cab drivers. Two were murdered. One in 10 weeks ago, so I think it was May. And his name was Gurpreet Singh. He was driving a cab in Richmond, California, and was shot. It was July 2nd. July 5th, another Sikh was shot. He fortunately was only shot in the jaw and was released from the hospital 3 or 4 days later. Then just last 2 weeks ago, a young Sikh, Devinder Singh, was shot and killed over what appears to be a robbery. But police can't really ever, I think, determine whether something's a robbery or a hate crime, because the fact that he had a turban and his beard on, I'm sure, made it a little easier to pull the trigger. One story I'd like to convey is that of the Sordi family. And the first instance happened actually September 15th, 2001. The first murder related to the 9/11 attacks domestically was committed by a gentleman in Arizona on Balbir Singh Sordi, a 52-year-old father of two and a gas station owner in Mesa, Arizona. He was out tending his flowers and doing some maintenance around his gas station when a patriot, as he were, came driving by in his truck, stopped and yelled, "This is for what you did to our country," and shot him several times. He died on the spot. The tragedy that faced his family is really kind of something that you can't fathom. An immigrant family losing their father, especially from a South Asian descent, where the father really is the basis of that whole family. Unfortunately, the tragedy doesn't end with that family, just with Balbir Singh's shooting. 15 months later, his brother here in San Francisco, Sukhpal Singh, was shot while he was driving his cab at 2 a.m. So this family had 5 sons, I believe 3 of which were sent to this country. And the mother back home in Punjab, India, was quoted in several newspapers as saying, "I want my other son to come home. We sent them there for a good life, and look what happens, they get gunned down." One of the other, I think, really major points that we need to bring up is that as a result, the majority of people that we see face hate crimes, in the Sikh community at least, are both cab drivers and retail store owners or workers. And this is primarily because of the fact that they have direct interaction with the public. If you work in an office building, it's probably a little less likely that somebody could bring an Uzi into the office and shoot you. Whereas if you work somewhere where petty cash is involved, there's a lot easier chance. This has brought about this reoccurring and kind of dangerous theme in the Sikh community that you're seeing Sikh men cutting their hair and removing their turbans. This is extraordinarily disturbing in the community. One, it's tempered by 2 things, the strength of your faith or the willingness to want to live. And can you fault someone who, I remember once again on the Berkeley campus, I had a family friend who owned a copy store, and I would walk by his store all the time and check in on him to say hello. And I can't count the number of times he told me, "Listen, you should maybe think about removing your turban, wearing a baseball cap." To me, it was never an option. I never thought of it that way. But to others who face this daily threat of being shot, being robbed, how can we honestly say that they're not just in love with their faith? It's something they have to do out of fright. And this is something that's been very disturbing to the Sikhs, not just in the Bay Area, but across the country, in that one of the key fundamentals of Sikhism is their identity. So to lose that identity in the diaspora is clearly something that will affect the faith from blossoming and staying strong. The community, I think, has also seen a number of other various different things, whether it be job discrimination. As we can see, a Sikh policeman in New York City went through the academy and was going to be a traffic cop. So I'm sure those of you who have been to New York have seen traffic cops in the street. He was not allowed, after he graduated from the academy, he was fired from his position because he wouldn't show his hair and remove his turban. These are the instances, I guess, that face the community, as the Sikh community here and abroad has felt attacked, obviously, with the attacks of 9/11, but also attacked domestically, once again, by bigoted patriots. So the community now feels not a question of what's going to happen next to them, but really when it's going to happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Kavneet. Our next speaker is Mr. Mario Campos, who is here tonight to share some information regarding the spillover effect of September 11th in the Latino community. Mario will be reading in Spanish, and his speech will be translated by Donna Hernandez.
Thank Thank you. A dos años del siniestro que conmovió al mundo, los latinos fuimos, somos y seguiremos siendo los protagonistas de este acontecimiento. Cuando sucedió esto, era parte de una organización y desarrollando un programa que beneficiaba a nuestra comunidad, que ahora ya no existe. Dentro de mis funciones, atendí una línea de asistencia que daba un servicio muy especial a nuestra gente.
2 years after the attacks that moved the world, the Latino community continues to be central characters of this event. When this happened, I was part of an organization and I was monitoring a program which no longer exists that assisted our immigrant community. I ran an assistance phone line that provided special services to our people.
Hubo un recorte en los fondos que da el Estado para soportar estos programas que fueron cerrados. Fui despedido por esta causa. He estado como voluntario en mi iglesia y otras organizaciones comunitarias. Ahora estoy sin empleo y ha sido muy duro para mí, esposa y yo. Ella trabaja y yo colecto desempleo. Para finalizar, este punto nosotros vivimos día a día.
There was a cut in state funding that led to the program's closing and I was laid off. I've been volunteering with my church and various community organizations now that I'm unemployed. It has been hard for my wife and I. She works, and I collect unemployment to make ends meet. At this point, we live from day to day.
Antes de septiembre 11, nuestros clientes extremaban más el servicio en buscar cómo ser ciudadanos de este país. Llamaban por asistencia, por servicios comunes como violencia doméstica, abuso de niños, ancianos, cómo obtener servicios de salud, cómo accesar a los programas de comida.
Before September 11, 2001, our clients used the program to gain assistance with becoming U.S. citizens and community issues like domestic violence, child abuse, health care, food programs, and senior citizen programs.
Después de esta tragedia, todo cambió. Empezó una persecución para nuestra gente, personas que tenían pendientes sus trámites y que pronto iban a ser resueltos, fueron detenidos, se buscó causas para ser deportados, muchas familias fueron separadas en aras de la seguridad de este país. Nuestra gente ha sido perseguida, cazada, buscada como delincuentes, como criminales.
After the tragedy of 9/11, everything changed. Our people were persecuted for their status. People who were looking forward to and were very close to becoming citizens were instead detained. The officials found minor reasons to deport them. Many families were separated because of national security. Our people have been followed and treated as if they were delinquent or criminals.
Nosotros, que hemos venido a este país en busca de un porvenir mejor, debido a que los gobiernos de nuestros países son corruptos a causa de la tolerancia de este país. Por eso venimos a esta tierra a trabajar, a desarrollar los trabajos que otros no quieren hacer, a ganar los peores sueldos, a no tener los servicios básicos para nuestro vivir, como educación, salud y servicios sociales. Esto es inexcusable.
Our people came to this country because we thought that we would have a better life here, an opportunity to advance. We figure this is owed to us because of the assistance and tolerance that our torturers at home received from the U.S. government. We came here to work and advance in jobs that no one else in this country will do, to earn the worst and lowest wages, and to not have basic services for advancement like education, health care, and social services is inexcusable.
Yo fui testigo de esta situación que ahora se justifica simplemente como la seguridad de nuestra nación. Yo sé esto porque estuve asistiendo gente que estaba cerca de tener su ciudadanía, tener una vida mejor, pero después de septiembre 11, cuando el programa fue cortado, yo siento mis manos atadas a mi espalda y sé que nada puedo hacer por ayudar.
I was a witness to this situation that is now justified by the so-called security of this nation. I knew that I was assisting people in getting one step closer to citizenship and living a better life. But after 9/11, when the program was cut, I felt like I had my hands tied behind my back, and I knew that there was nothing that I could do to help.
Yo me pregunto, ¿cómo es posible que se asigne millones de dólares en asistencia para cuidar nuestras fronteras y para VCIs, nuevas siglas del Servicio de Inmigración, asignen una mínima cantidad, que son las oficinas a donde los inmigrantes tienen los casos pendientes por años? Esto significa que el atraso va a ser mayor para que nuestra gente pueda obtener sus documentos.
I ask myself how millions of dollars can be so easily awarded to things like national security and border patrol, and yet they can award a minimum amount of money to organizations that have been assisting immigrants for years. This only means one thing to me. It is going to be a long time before any of these people will receive proper documentation.
Todas estas situaciones que han ocurrido después de septiembre 11 han empoderado a muchas organizaciones a elevar un grito de protesta, a ser voz de los sin voz, a iniciar una marcha por la libertad, la esperanza, por los derechos de los trabajadores e inmigrantes, pidiendo una legalización. Nuestros representantes del área salieron el 23 de este mes, una caravana que atravesará los Estados Unidos, expuestos a muchos peligros, represalias, de aquellos que ven a los inmigrantes como un enemigo, hasta llegar a Washington, D.C., a donde se reunirán con las otras caravanas de los otros estados, y se piensa reunir 250,000 inmigrantes con la única consigna, pedir justicia. Gracias.
All of these situations that have occurred since September 11, 2001, have in turn empowered many organizations to scream out in protest, to be a voice for those whose voices have been taken away from them, to initiate a liberty march in hope that immigrant workers will have equal rights, and to ask for legalization. Our representatives from this area departed on September 23rd in a caravan that will travel the U.S. amidst these dangerous moments through towns that may consider immigrants as their enemies to Washington, D.C. In D.C., they will reunite with other caravans from other states, and close to 250,000 immigrants will be there to ask for one thing, justice.